right now, we're going to go back to the summer of 1960, July 30th of 1960, to be precise, for a very early, one of the earliest of the known Gene Shepherd recordings, when he was doing long-form shows. This is not an overnight program, but I believe, let's see, Saturdays he was on in the evening or in the morning. I'm confused. I meant to look it up, because his schedule changed, varying between, I think he was on, you know, semi-late night on Saturday, and then came back on Sunday morning for an 11 a.m. show. We'll fill you in at the end of the show. But from sometime on a Saturday, on July 30th, 1960, we're going to hear Gene Shepherd. Tropical Storm Brenda has hit New York as this program commences. And Shepherd goes to sea. It's a 90-minute program. And as far as I know, it's relatively complete, although the person who recorded these originally, some of the shows were 2 hours long. Other shows were 90 minutes long. So he just threw on a 90-minute tape on his tape recorder, and it ran until the tape ran out. So not all of these programs that this fellow recorded in 1960 are complete. We'll see how complete this one is. I think it comes on, and maybe it doesn't have a beginning. At any rate, a very special treat, Gene Shepherd, here on a Sunday night, Tony night, in place of everything old is new again. This is kind of a treat and a reward for people who sat through the Gene Shepherd fundraising program, and I promised that we would bring a lengthy, complete bit of Shepherd to you on this point. So here it is. As soon as the tape rolls around to the beginning, this is WBAI, New York.
You can tell by the looks on their faces as they go scurrying through the rain. Maybe we pushed it too far this time. Maybe we have pushed it too far this time, and finally that gigantic, that tremendous sledge, that hammer, is going to come right out of a clump. Boom! New York is gone. You know, it's a fascinating thing for an outlander, for someone who lives way an outlander, to observe what New York does during the slightest indication that weather might be glowering just a little bit. Could it be possible that New York has a fantastic case of conscience? That New York's great abstract life, you know, we're constantly writing about New York, talking about New York, writing how it feels to live in New York, and people like Truman Capote, people like Esquire, what's this guy from Playboy? All these people are writing constantly about the mystique of New York. And of course, it has become increasingly abstract. More and more, New York life bears a relationship to no other life. It is New York life. There are people who are alive, you know, way out there wandering around the hills and bumping into each other in Chillicothe, way out there in the dark fastnesses of, you know, for want of a better word, the outer darkness. Out there in the boondocks, I might use a better known phrase, way out there in the, you know. And here we are, we're all gathered together, huddled here, if you please, in New York. And somehow we have gotten the ingrown feeling of a faculty. You know what faculty life is like in a college that's way off in the hills someplace, up to say out in Princeton or Dartmouth or somewhere. The ingrown life of the faculty is an interesting thing, very interesting thing to observe. It grows kind of, well, it's ingrown. It's like this toe within a sock, within a shoe, within an overshoe, within a drift of snow. And it's all by itself. It has no context. Lives beyond the context of its own little leaves and its own files. It has no real contact with the outside world. Once in a while, a new group of students will come in, and they will absorb those students. But the students are always on the periphery, just as the tourist is on the periphery here in Manhattan. He comes, he goes. For a while, he sings and dances with us, but never is part of us. And then he departs, but we stay. We are the faculty of New York. And as we grow more and more ingrown, we become more and more insular. We have our own mores, our own mode of operation. And so we write our own literature. We, of course, and I'm not even speaking of Damon Runyon, who never wrote, as far as I'm concerned, the literature of New York. Runyon wrote Runyonese. But nevertheless, we have our own literature. It pours out of the news. It pours out of the indignant pulp pages of the Post, always angry about things which... And then you have the good, calm, vaguely fuzzy voice of the New York Times ponderously moving along a concrete highway that's a circular highway, of course. And we have our own literature. We're our own mores, our own world, our own way of being. That the, let's say, the mystique of Horn and Hardart is always and will forever be lost on the tourist, the man from Cleveland. I know, you know, the man from Cleveland comes, with the nickels, you know, always what I heard about, the automat, you know. But it isn't the automat. You hardly ever hear it called the automat to people living in New York. It's something else. But here's this mystique growing. It's an inner circle. And once in a while, you see, this is where we get to the point of this thing here. Now sit up straight, will you? I mean, just because it's Saturday, sit up. Sit up. I'm awfully tired. This whole miserable business. I mean, you're getting a crimp. I'm getting a crimp. We're all crimped. And so we sit here in this circle, this sewing circle that is Manhattan. And once in a while, from the outer world will come the slight suggestion of a wind. What was that? We turn, look over our shoulders. Or maybe a little rain will come down broad. What's this wet stuff? Of course, we're used to wet stuff. I was over on the east side the other day in the 60s. Let me tell you, have you ever pulled up, say, about 2 o'clock in the morning in the 60s somewhere in the east side over on 2nd, over there in Tristville, you know, where all these big new fancy apartments have gone up and all these great big fancy balconies are out looking out over the river? Oh, this is Expensiveville. This is Expensicomptville, if I ever saw it. See, and it's over there. You pull up about 2 o'clock in the morning and you get out of a cab or you get out. Incidentally, only cabs are fitting in that neighborhood there. It's the transient world, you know. And have you ever had the feeling that you're going to go to hell in a cab? You know, paying the fare and the meter's ticking all the way. And so you get out of a cab. I did this just the other night. I get out of a cab over there in the East 60s. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I hear this. And it's all around me. Not a soul is stirring, not even a mouse. And there's a faint moisture in the air. And I had just left the west side where all was pristine and calm and quiet. And I couldn't figure out what it was. I thought, is it the river flowing past? What is it? And then it dawned on me. It was Air Conditionerville. And the whole world there was air conditioned. And I looked up, and all these sleeping apartments you could hear humming. It's a frightening thing, really. It really is. You can hear it. It's getting more and more. At 3 o'clock in the morning, all the apartments go... And once in a while, you hear the little metal flaps of the what are they? Little ventilators on the side of these things. And then you'll hear a rattly old air conditioner that's about 9 years old. Somewhere or some guy hasn't quite made it up there on the 7th floor. And he's in a rent-controlled apartment, and they'll get him out before the first of the year, you know it. And they're all spitting this little moisture, spitting it out at you. You stand there in the middle of the street, and you begin to realize that you are now living in the contained, transistorized good life of the 20th century. That these are the truly insular people. We in New York, we like to think that out in the Midwest, they are isolationist. Oh, you have no idea how isolationist New York is. It's even isolationist about New Jersey, 15 feet away. And we're living in this little faculty, all of us together. And once in a while, there'll be this little breeze come down the street. Somebody will say, whoa, what was that? And the guy next to him said, that was a wind, I think. A wind. A wind. A wind. A wind. A wind. win. And then 10 minutes later, there will be an extra large drop will come down. Oh, what was that? Somebody's air conditioner? That's rain. And within 5 minutes, all over the dial, you hear nothing but a constant hullabaloo. Television, radio, all they're talking about is this thing that came from the outside world, this rain. Have you listened to the newscast today? This piddling little rain we're getting here. This miserable little rain. And I'm listening to the newscast 15 minutes of time. And on 46th Street, there were over 2 inches of water. And on 23rd Street, there were 7 inches of water. And 14 old ladies had to get out of their car. And, oh, it was terrible. Oh, it's so awful here. You have no idea what it's... And, ladies and gentlemen, the barometer is going up and down and sideways. And the multiple... And it goes, you see. And it sounds like a fantastic disaster has hit Manhattan. What it is the outside world has hit Manhattan, which is a disaster in itself. We are becoming aware of something, you see, that out there is that world. And it goes on and on and on like this in this little faculty world. You know how a faculty is. I'll give you a little insight into the faculty world. That the slightest little ripple causes gigantic waves, because they got nothing else to do, you know. They're all sitting around there on their duffs, all looking at each other suspiciously, all waiting for somebody to move into the department. That sharp young man from Dartmouth who wrote that monograph, that idiotic thing, that, you know, that. And they're all waiting for this thing to happen, just as we are in our wonderful little insular world here. And it's fascinating to me. Coming from, have you ever seen what kind of rains they get in Omaha? Oh, buddy. Have you ever seen every 3 weeks in the winter in Circleville, Ohio, the snow suddenly is up to the roofs. And during the summertime, plagues of locusts, one after the other. Gigantic, thundering tornadoes. I remember a tornado that went right through a little town in Michigan, and 10 minutes after it went through, knocked down 17 houses, nobody said anything about it. I don't know what they would do in New York if a tornado ever struck Times Square. I mean, it would be the biggest thing. We would be talking about it till well into January. It would be fantastic. And the only point that I'm making here is that most of the decisions about that outside world are made right here in this little insular world. Along Madison Avenue and Lexington, there are thousands of guys who are sitting there figuring out what to say to the people in Circleville, Ohio, to make them feel even more insecure. And they're sitting out there stolidly in Circleville. The tornado goes past, and after a while, they can hear the buzzing of the locust wings. They can hear the chewing of the cutworm out on the tomato vines. And he knows about the real world out there. And we here, you know, we live in this wonderful, soft, warm... We're all sitting... You know, I had this feeling. There's a funny feeling about this. I just got back from a cruiser, from a missile cruiser. And we're sailing 150 or 200 miles way out into the Atlantic. We took off from Boston, and we went out into that darkness, that eternal sea out there. And you see the porpoises rising and falling, and you can see a whale blowing way off the starboard bow. And then night falls until finally there's nothing but that dark inverted bowl, that eternal night. And let me tell you, I'm standing up there on the flying bridge, and I can see nothing but darkness. Billions and billions and billions of skies, all as far as one can see, and all the stars that you could ever imagine. And the ship is cutting through that black water at about 30 knots. You can hear an occasional banging somewhere, down, way down in the hold of this thing, or a creaking sound. Not a single light going, we're cutting through that water. You can feel the spray. And it's a strange feeling, you see. I don't know which is the real world, this world of the ship, which is as insular as anything you can imagine, or that crazy world that I have just left. And as the ship comes steaming back, and slowly I'm getting drawn into this, I can hear the cacophony rising. You can hear the trumpeting and the bellowing and the booming and the crashing and the banging and the shrieking and the wailing and the moaning rising from the eternal squadrons of the damned as I move back into Manhattan. And I'm once again in this fantastic, strange, whirling vortex, the whirlpool. I remember this story about... Now, I don't know which is the real world, you see. We're scuttering out there in the darkness, and there's nothing but sky and water. And this Steel Hulk, speaking of Hulks, this is WORAM at FM New York. Speaking of Hulks, as Long John would say, it's time to take care of a bit of business. Filter. Now, can you tell me which is the real world? Would you, before you put that away, Jimmy, just 1 second here. Now, we're talking about the real world. Now, hold it there for a second. I'll give you the cue. Now, remember this. I am standing on the flying bridge of a steel gray cruiser, like a long sullen greyhound cutting through that black sea of the Atlantic, rising and falling eternally the way it's risen and fallen, up and down, rising and falling and reaching. Oh, yes, reaching, always reaching. Always reaching. Joseph Conrad, you know, I'm standing on the bridge of this thing, looking down at that black water, and it's scuttering past us at 30, 32 knots, something like that. And I'm looking at this water, and I realize that if I ever somehow was washed overboard, or if I was walking along one of the rails and just slipped and skittered under the rail and out, I would be gone forever. There would be no coming back. At this time of night, at this place, and at this very instant, in this ocean, we were on the edge of the Labrador Current, and it was bitter, icy, cold water. And you could feel that steely, ice-pick kind of wind that cut along the side, over the bridge, and back over the conning tower, and finally out, over the fantail. And you could hear that wind hissing and whistling through those radar dishes just above us. Up and down we're going. I'm looking out over in that water, and I can see an occasional whitecap kicking up. You can hear the sea. And I'm thinking about what Joseph Conrad said. Conrad said, in effect, in a short story, a magnificent short story, no one ever wrote about the sea like Conrad, with the possible exception of Herman Melville. You know, all the British writers, all the European writers, wrote more about society. The American writers in the early days of American letters dealt almost conclusively and eternally with those dark forces that lay just outside the guttering hiss of the campfire. And Melville was one of them. But Conrad, a British writer, also dealt with the sea. And his remark about the sea is that anyone who loves the sea, and I'm wildly paraphrasing him here, anyone who loves the sea is crazy. Since the sea does not love, the sea knows no passion. The sea is purely mechanical. Purely and utterly and thoroughly mechanical. It's like saying, I love this piece of sand. I love this rock, but with a difference. The sea is not only mechanical, but is a killer that rises and falls. And I'm standing on that flying bridge, and I can feel just the touch of spray and that fantastic darkness and those billion stars above us. And I can see way over somewhere in my mind only, way over somewhere, this wild, cacophonic, fantastic rising and falling hoopla, brouhaha, roar and pitch and steam of the thing I had just left, New York, that little faculty, that booming, bellowing faculty of which I have been part of, caught up with, ensnarled with, enmeshed by, for so long I can't remember anything else now. And I'm standing on this flying bridge, and I'm looking down at this water, and I realize if I go in that water, there is no more, ever. And there's a guy standing next to me. He says, did I ever tell you about the time this guy I knew that was on a British freighter, they were out in the South Seas, he got to talking about falling in the water. He said, there was this guy who was a third mate on a freighter out in the South Seas. He said, I knew the guy. And they had just left an island port, and they were heading east. And they were in the darkest, deepest, most shark-ridden part of the Pacific. The water was warm and soupy, but oh, so deadly. And it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and the third mate is the officer of the day, and he's making his rounds of the deck, just quietly walking around. He gets around to the fantail, and there were maybe two or three men awake on this ship. This little old freighter was beating her way. And he looks down over the fantail. He's examining the screws. He's making sure that he's making a check. He's making sure that everything is working fine. When suddenly the ship took a slight roll when he didn't expect it, and he was pitched right off into that darkness. over that fantail of that hissing, steaming, boiling, shark-ridden Pacific water. And he saw nothing but the lights of that ship retreating. He was wearing a white T-shirt, he was wearing a pair of white shorts, and a pair of those low-cut gym shoes. That's all he had. He's floating there all by himself in that eternal grave. And he sees that ship going off into the distance. And he knew that they wouldn't find out that he was gone until they changed watches 4 hours hence. He knew it. And he knew that when they found this out, they would be 4 hours away. And he knew that the moment they found it out, they would probably turn around and steam back to where they thought perhaps he might have been lost. 4 hours back, or thereabouts. So hence he had a minimum of 8 hours to float in that deserted sea on one of the lesser used, way off the beaten track, little known sea routes. It would be as if you're lost on a gravel road 1,000 miles away from the turnpike. Don't expect them to come and find you here. And so he lay on his back and looked up at the stars and just lay there. He knew that it was 8 hours. He set his mind for 8 hours and just quietly paddled and tried to stay above water. And that sea heaved. And sure enough, within 10 minutes, a shark came nosing around in the darkness. Can you imagine a shark at 4 o'clock in the morning in the darkness in an unknown sea? And the first indication he had of the shark, it was so dark, was that it nuzzled him. Moved up and just went boom, boom. With that great big leathery nose up against his ribs. Boom. And he stiffened. And the instant you stiffen when you're trying to float on your back, you sink. Down he went. He relaxed again and floated to the surface. Boom! This thing hit him again. And he lay there. He moved his left hand casually, easily, trying not to startle anything, trying not to tip the boat. And then when he got into position, he just shot out with his foot. Socko! And he kicked the shark between the eyes. Just boom. And the shark moved back and began to circle. And every 10 minutes thereafter, the shark would move in and just sort of nuzzle him. He would kick again. And then the shark was joined by a second shark. Until finally, as the rosy-fingered dawn was quietly trickling its fingernails over that eternal grave, he saw that there were at least 10 or 12 sharks just circling around looking at him. And the sun began to beat down. And then suddenly, without warning, the sharks disappeared, which was even more frightening. All together, they just... whoosh. It's now about 7 o'clock in the morning. He's looking up at the sky, and he says, well, they'll find out about it in just about an hour. I've been here 3 hours now. And he's getting sick. Have you ever bobbed up and down in a rowboat, lying on your back, looking up at the sky? 20 minutes of that, and you're getting ready to let go of every meal you've ever had in your life. Every meal you ever had. And he's lying there nauseous and sick, bobbing up and down. And the water is beginning to sting him. You lie too long in salt water, and that Pacific salt water is even saltier than the salt water. And you begin to get that crawly feeling on your skin. That feeling as though death itself is somehow sneaking up on you, and death has a rough skin. Death is rough like mohair. And you lie there and you look up, and he's looking out, and suddenly he sees this great hulk coming up beside him, an enormous hulk. Something black is coming up out of the sea. I'm telling you a true story. And he looks, and it's a turtle. Have you ever seen pictures of these giant Solomon Islands turtles? Here's this enormous sea turtle with great flippers. Now, these things are not carnivorous, really. Just sort of, you know, they're just sort of like a ward heaver. Kind of friendly and a little sneaky and untrusty. But at the same time, big. Oh, they throw their own weight. And this great big turtle just bobbed up next to him and swam slowly over and looked him right in the face. Raised his old head out of the water and looked at him. And then ducked his head down and bumped him like a great big fat 2-ton beach ball. Boom. Donnie went in the water again. Now he's really sick. He's got another mouthful of salt water. He bobs up, and the turtle just continues to nudge him along a little bit. Like this. And he realizes that three more bumps like this, and he is done. He is done. He is waterlogged. He is soaked. He will not be able to come back. So he hangs onto the side of the turtle's shell so that the turtle can't get around in front of him again. And there the two of them are out there in that giant eternal ocean, that sea. He's clinging to the side of the turtle, and he realizes now the turtle is giving him a little rest. The turtle is just quietly flapping his flippers and once in a while going, bleh. You know how turtles do. You know, this problem, this is a diet problem. I mean, it's an awful, awful bad diet. Bleh. He's flapping his flippers, and this guy is hanging on to the flippers out there. And by this time, the sharks are back again, but they see now he has a friend. And he is clinging to the turtle, and the turtle is just quietly going, bleh, bleh. And once in a while, the turtle submerges a little bit. Bleh. He goes under, looks around, and this guy just quietly floats to the surface like a bobber. And he waits. And the turtle comes back, and this continues for about another hour and a half. And then just as suddenly as it began, they disappeared. Turtle, sharks, and all. And that sun began to crack down. It was now about 10 o'clock in the morning. He was so sick, he couldn't see the sky. He couldn't see the water. He just lay on his back. He's been in the water now for 6 hours, only on the hope that this ship might come back. Only on the hope, that's all, a very slim one. And he didn't trust the skipper anyway, really. It's a no-good type. And so he lay on his back with that sun beating down, and he began to feel the skin peeling off of his forehead and his cheeks. The salt water was working on him. The sun was working on him. And once in a while, he would see high overhead, way, way high overhead, a flight of seabirds. You don't call to the terns. You don't call to the kestrels. And occasionally, an albatross goes slowly moving across the horizon, and he lay. And sure enough, 20 minutes before the 8 hours were up, he sees coming over the horizon a tiny dot. It is his ship. And for the very first moment, he felt a tremendous, overwhelming, completely engulfing panic. He really felt panic. Panic because now he saw. He saw the very glimmerings of something that might save him. He saw that they might not save him, even more possibly, because the sea was a heavy, heaving sea. And if you've ever tried to see a tiny, bobbing, single head on a sea, this is, you know, this business of needles and haystacks is chicken feed and kid stuff. And he's bobbing. And he began to panic. And as he began to panic, he began to struggle. And as he began to struggle, he began to be sicker. And as he began to be sicker, everything began to spin and get blue and green, and he practically passed out just because of the panic. And then he saw that the ship was slowly beginning to come about. They were giving up the search. They had searched for 4 hours back over that route. He says, no. He's gone. Let's go. We're losing time. And then, just at the last instant, believe it or not, somebody, a seaman, walking along the rail who wasn't even on lookout, looked out over the horizon and saw that tiny dot. They put down a boat, and they pulled him out of the water. And the instant they pulled him out of the water, he broke down completely, thoroughly, utterly, and completely. Didn't regain his senses for maybe 10 days, 3 days after they'd been in port. And for weeks after that, he was still out at sea. For weeks after that, he was still getting bumped by turtles, nuzzled by whales. Which is the real world? Which is the real world? I'm out there on the flying bridge, and I see that black water scuttering past, and all I can hear is New York in the distance. All I can do is... Ah, New York! This is it! This is the real world! This is what we want!
There's a great new gasoline from...
That's the real world. Boy, it's good to be back here where it's real. Glad to be back. Glad to be with you folks. I'll award you the brass fig leaf with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me who it was who said, Brent, we could get together, folks. You know, I saw a cartoon. Speaking of that, you see, the point that we're trying to raise here is that we are living a life of such complete abstraction here in Manhattan. Such complete abstraction that any time anything that even smacks of the real sneaks down Broadway and gets our pants legs wet, there is a fantastic panic that goes through us. What is that out there? Oh, we're pushing it too far. We're pushing it too far. And a giant male fist one day is going to come. Can't you just hear that on a newscast? Ladies and gentlemen, from the WOR newsroom, we just have received reports that an enormous golden chariot was seen 4,000 feet over West Babylon, Long Island, driven by a man wearing a gold helmet, shooting bolts of thunder and lightning from his left hand as he drove his golden steeds in the general direction of Montauk Point. When we get further information, we'll return to this point. Stay tuned for further notes from the WOR newsroom about the Golden Chariot disaster. And now back to the top 40 favorites. Good to be back here in the permanent world. You know, speaking of the permanent world, there was this friend of mine who said, you know, when I was young, when I was a kid, he said, when I was a flaming idealistic youth, I used to listen to the politicians speak. And incidentally, I'd like to make a point here. I think that one of the prevailing sicknesses that we have is to suspect deeply, thoroughly, and completely the politician. And we have this thing, you know, all the time, people say, oh, well, it's a politician. No. They are just us. So don't put, I mean, a politician is just us. And he has no more phoniness in him, and he has no more goodness, he has no more omniscience in him than 90% of the rest of us, poor fellow treaders of this yellow brick road in the eternal search for the Emerald City. He's no more phony. He's no... I know a thousand businessmen I wouldn't trust. I wouldn't trust beyond the site, beyond the next bend, just past the water cooler. And they're the first ones who say, you can't trust a politician. I'm sitting there with a cab driver who has just euchred me out of 15 cents change by a neat, quick movement of the palm. He says, I can't trust those politicians. And that phony has been knocking down ever since they took the tax off. All up and down the line. And this friend of mine, you know, he's it's interesting, you know, how we identify or don't identify. We want... Somebody made the point in the Village Voice there that I thought it was very well taken. I hope that somebody picks this up. But that's beside the point. We'll save that for tomorrow night. This friend of mine was... We were talking about the whole thing. You know, I can't recall any time ever that I have become more deeply embroiled or more involved or more interested. Not involved, unfortunately. We're only involved by just sort of standing around, but more interested in what is happening in the world than today. I think we're living in historical times, really historical times. All times are historical, but sometimes are more than others, mean more than others. It's just like your daily life. You might have four or five moments in your day that are much more significant than the other moments that have led up to it and that follow it. And I think that we're living in a momentous, truly a momentous period now. There's no question about it. It's been moving this way for probably 40 years. And now it's kind of coming to a climax. And we are embattled and we don't know which way to turn. If you notice that hardly any political man, any politician really talks about the fact that hardly anywhere in the world can you find a real friend. That everywhere, every place you look, backs are being turned on us, in spite of the loud assurances to the contrary. Now, this is a fascinating thing to see. Not so much that backs are being turned on us, because at every point in history there has been a patsy. We're patsy number one right now, and 10 years from now, I'm quite sure that there will be another patsy. That the world will turn its back on, because always, always, man has had to have something to stick pins into, to somehow give him a sense that the rottenness that's happening in his life is somebody else's fault. Always have had to have this thing. It's a patsy. We're the patsy now. But have you noticed that hardly anybody really talks about it, except in the broadest of generalities? Because we're living in such an interesting dream world. We're living in such a fascinating world. I was listening to a politician the other day talk incessantly about how many more cars people have today. How many more television sets. How many more breezeways. Now, what are you people complaining about? These professional groom dealers are constantly, he says, and he goes on. And this is a great leader. A great leader. And I kept hearing the echoes of some guy standing on the side of a limpid pool in Rome. And he's standing up there with his long robes hanging around him, and he's waving his hand in the air, and he's saying, what are you complaining about? What are you talking about? The sore heads are always coming up talking about these barbarians. Look, you had more grapes per capita last year than ever before. More men can afford three or more Nubian handmaidens today than ever before. What are you complaining about? Under my administration, and it goes on and on. I keep hearing the echoes of the same thing. Always. And this friend of mine is listening to the speeches going on, and he says, you know, when I was young, when I was a kid, by young he means in his teens, in his early 20s, he says, when I was a kid, I used to say, isn't it terrible that these politicians don't believe what they say? I mean, isn't it awful that they don't believe what they say? And he had the feeling that all this political talk, you know, was just talk. You know, they didn't believe it. And then he says, now I listen, and I say, wouldn't it be awful if they believed it? Isn't it terrible if they really believed this stuff? Oh. And so, I mean, it's all part of the wonderful dream world in which we're all involved. And hardly any of us, you know, really feel an involvement. We all feel as though we're onlookers. And so we've come to the point now where we have great crowds of comedians, quote, going over the scene who are the so-called dispassionate onlookers. Who just, you know, and today, of course, that's the easiest kind of humor. You can take any situation, any condition, any man, any moment in any man's life. And since all of us are frail, and since all of us have the inadequacy of the ungodlike, you can make humor of any moment in any man's life. It's a simple, easy process. I remember seeing a cartoon. In fact, it's in the current issue. It's a beautiful cartoon. One of the few really meaningful cartoons that I have seen in Esquire in a long time. And it's a full-page cartoon. It's in the August issue. I have cut this out, and it is going on my wall of my office. And here it is. It shows the raging fires of hell, the inferno, great roaring flames and dark blackness, and you could see the lost souls sailing out. And there in the foreground, you see a boat crossing the River Styx. And you could see those angry waters. And those hooded, shrouded souls, those damned souls weeping and wailing. And you see this fiend poling along in the back. And sitting in the front, sitting up there in the bow, is Dante. Looking very cool, looking very casual. And he's watching. He's sitting back and he's looking at those damned souls moving into the eternal darkness. And he's sitting back there on his duff with his legs crossed. And one of the poor, blighted, unfortunate is looking at him with a harassed face. And Dante, with a slight smile, is saying, "Oh, I don't mind it, really. I'm only here to gather material for a book." "Whither goest indeed, O thou mankind?" It's like, you know, speaking of Dante and the Inferno and all. Did you read this little news? This is symbolic of our time. We have this great desire to do it, and nobody knows why. All of mankind has. And occasionally one poor soul will do it. Listen to this one from San Francisco. San Francisco. Everett Wong beat the odds. On July 6th, his car plunged over Devil's Slide, an ocean-bordering cliff south of San Francisco where many a motorist has been killed in the past. Wong's car rolled over and over and over for 170 feet and ended in a crumbled, smashed mass of metal, a terrible, misshapen heap. But Wong painfully crawled out alive. "He should have been killed," an officer at the scene said. "I've never seen anything like it." Wong's wife, Alice, noted that he became despondent immediately after the accident. Monday, the body of the 36-year-old real estate man was found in a cement courtyard below his apartment. To gain death, he had cheated. Wong had jumped 35 feet, hopping over his air conditioner as he left.
Over WOR Radio, your station for news.
James McCarthy reporting. For up-to-the-minute reports, stay tuned to this station. Now, the news. Well, President Eisenhower was forced to cancel his trip back east today due to that young lady by the name of Brenda. That story from Sanford Marshall in New York.
And we may or may not pick up that story. Just a reminder at 9:53 that you are tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. And in place of Dave Kenny this evening, we're listening to Gene Shepherd on his Saturday afternoon program. The broadcast time was 12:15 to 2 p.m. And it's the July 30th, 1960 program. I don't know if the news is intact here. I see some of the commercials have been cut out of this program already. But this runs for, another 50 minutes or so. So let's get back to it. Hurricane Brenda. Let's see if the news continues or if it goes back to the program. I just don't remember.
The East Coast is in the throes of a tropical storm. Waterlogged New Yorkers went to their phones this morning to discover why and heard this.
Tropical storm Brenda causing heavy rains, high winds, and high tides until early afternoon with partial clearing and diminishing winds and subsiding tides later this afternoon.
Yes, Tropical Storm Brenda was moving up the East Coast at about 35 miles an hour, but she is losing her tropical characteristics. She is now just a windy, wet storm, but she'll be spreading that rain, rough wind, and high tides for the next 12 to 38 hours. This is Sanford Marshall in New York. Now back to James McCarthy in Washington.
And we'll have more news in a moment. On the political scene, pressure is due from both sides of the congressional fence when it reconvenes next month. But the Democrats have made it known today there will be no stalling around about it. Ed Semprini reports from Kennedy headquarters, Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Running mates Senators John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson today singled out medical care for the aged, housing, aid to education, and mutual appropriations as the key issues on the legislative calendar for the forthcoming session of Congress. The Democratic teammates met newsmen at Hyannisport together for the first time since the nominations in Los Angeles. Johnson attacked the administration for what he called its lack of foreign policy, defense, and new ideas. Regarding the GOP convention, Johnson said, "The big difference between 1860 and 1960 for them is Lincoln." This is Ed Semprini reporting from WOCB, Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Now back to James McCarthy in Washington.
Well, America, in case you're lolling around the house right about now and thinking how nice and calm it is, here's something that should shake you out of your doldrums. The quiet war is back on in Korea. At last reports, a South Korean destroyer escort tangled with a commie North Korean gunboat 4 miles at sea today and sent the rocks right down, right down to the bottom. In a naval gunfight, which lasted about 5 minutes, the rock craft engaged the enemy in what is the first confirmed battle and the first sinking of a commie vessel since the 1953 armistice ending the Korean War. Shortly after the destroyer sent the gunboat to the bottom, a spray of 3 communist torpedo boats appeared on a retaliation mission. No reports on that action, though. That's the news to now. James McCarthy reporting.
And if the truth were out, I suspect that most of us see, most of us understand life as a kind of gigantic foot race. Billions and billions and billions of us plunging along, thundering along, charging forward in a great cloud of dust that rises up into the sky and glints in the yellowish sun. A fantastically exhausting race. And a race that seems to have no end at all, but just a race. Everyone is thundering along together. And once in a while, one poor unfortunate or two or three are thrown off onto the curbstone to lie gasping and, of course, completely outdistanced within the next 30 seconds. This is the concept of life that I suspect is the most valid concept for the New Yorker today. A gigantic foot race. And have you ever had the feeling that if you ever stopped to look at the sky, just to look, you know, that they would catch up with you and pass you, go right on past, thundering on past? I have this friend who every time he goes on vacation has little earphones plugged into his ears. He's connected to his office by a set of radio phones. His boat is never out of touch with the world, ever. And constantly they're bringing messages to him, constantly, because he wants to stay in the race and at the same time look at the sky, which, of course, is a complete impossibility, because the kind of sky that I am speaking of is the sky that has no messages being brought to you by runners. And this is the sky that we're all afraid of. I can't get out of touch. I have this friend who once in a while is called out of New York for a couple of weeks for military service or something. He's the only guy I know in military service that is in constant touch night and day with his agent. He's the only guy I know who gets permission from his first sergeant to call his agent during guard duty. And his answering service every 2 hours has been instructed to call the post-service club to let him know whether Zanuck has called. He is never out of touch. The foot race goes on in the great thundering herd, the crashing and the roaring. And yet, you know, there are two kinds of people, really. There are the people who once in a while take their mind away from looking at the sky and try half-heartedly to get into the race. Because, you see, there is something in the air that makes it indecent to spend your life looking at the sky. Not only indecent, but vaguely immoral. And so, once in a while, you look up at the sky, and you pull down, and you say, I really should get... And then you make a half-hearted attempt. You call your agent. Is there anything, Charlie?
Yes, there is something. And that something is time to turn over the tape. If so, just about 10 o'clock, you're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. This is something like an extended golden age of radio, filling in for Dave Kenny, who will return next week, probably at the new time of 11 o'clock, golden age next week at 9 o'clock, assuming that the new schedule, the juggernaut, is rolling on as I was told it would. Yes, many programs moving around here at WBAI, so pay attention and listen for announcements. At any rate, we now resume with Gene Shepherd from July 30th, 1960.
You pull down and say, I really should get... And then you make a half-hearted attempt. You call your agent. Is there anything, Charlie? Oh, good to hear from you again. Where you been? Well, I'm around. You know. And, of course, the implication when he says, where you been? You know. Oh, poor sap. And you can hear the thundering roar of the hoofbeats going through his office as you're in touch once again with the great race. And you know you can never catch up, you know. Have you ever seen a dog race? That's one of the saddest of all races to see, you know, because the goal is out in front of them. When you see a horse race, there's a complete meaninglessness to a horse race. I mean, they run past. There's no meaning. And we like to believe that one horse has a rivalry inside of him to beat another. No. Come on. Now. That's that poor old idiotic thing that Walt Disney started years ago, that animals are really people in disguise and are somehow better. No, that's silly. Get it out of your mind, out of your skull. Peggy, cats are not people. No. They are carnivores, dear. And given the chance, they will carnivore on you, which is another story. They're just too small to get away with it. Now, incidentally, this is another thing. We have a concept of friends, you know. It's like all of us think the natives love us because they come up nuzzling up to the little house we've established in the jungle to hand them aspirins and rock and roll records. But given the alternative, they would come nuzzling up with something else. And if you don't believe this, take a look at the current Life magazine and see all the people being chased over the veldt in Africa. Literally being chased. It's just a matter of choice, you see. The cat has no choice but to be this friendly little thing that curls in your... But given another, say, 200 pounds, the cat is another story indeed, my dear. Another story. But that's all beside the point, you see. The horses are just things, you know. They run. But you go to a dog race. You see, I learned a lot about this problem of the thundering herd one time when I was inadvertently admitted to a dog track outside of Miami at one point in my career when I was working for the government. I had risen to the rank of PFC rapidly by diligent study, and I was allowed a few hours off from the tether. And somehow or other, I wound up in a dog track, of all places, when you're in the Army to be. I mean, this is more of... I can't tell you how symbolic this was, how meaningful it became. It was could very well have been one of the turning points in my life. Have you ever wondered how in the world you got to be what you are? Where the turning points really were? How come you didn't wind up Harlow Curtis or something? I mean, he's obviously no more brighter than... Hey, speaking of that, did you read that fantastic thing on the front page of the New York Times, The Triumph of PR Over the Truth? Incidentally, you know what public relations is? You know, most people think public relations is advertising. It's completely different. It's the opposite, you see. Advertising takes that little itsy-bitsy thing that you think is better that you have than other people have, and they blow it up into a fantastic blimp. You see, this is advertising. Oh, no. PR is the opposite. I mean, when you got this rotten thing that's hanging on you like a barnacle, PR steps in and makes it good. You see, they do the opposite. And this is quite true, you know. For example, when there's a strike in an enormous plant, you don't think the ad men step in, do you? And take out ads about... No, it's the PR men who say that there's just a little momentary riffle in our friendly, wonderful, happy family, but we're all really sitting around the same table pitching the same... Oh, yeah, that's right. It's all part of PR. And it was this beautiful story that kind of exemplifies the dream world of our day. There was the president. Did you see it on the front page of the Times? I almost fell sideways right off the curb on 57th Street when I got this one. It was the funniest piece of Americana that I've seen in a long time. It seems that they nabbed the president of one of the major automobile concerns with $450,000 in his jeans. And the PR men immediately stepped in and said, Mr. L.B. Watanabe has arrived at a settlement with the Watanabe Motor Company for $450,000, which apparently came about through a mistake in bookkeeping and a mistake in aims. We have reached a settlement. Mr. Watanabe has resigned. I can see the settlement. Can't you see them dragging this guy in from his plush office, kicking and screaming, two FBI men on each side, and one guy behind him with a sawed-off shotgun, and they drag him in, and the money is all taken out of his $450,000 by a misunderstanding of the bookkeeping methods. And they lay it out, and they say, all right, Charlie, now what? It's either the pokey or hand the dough over. He hands the dough over, and a settlement has been reached. A settlement. This is a settlement in our time. You see, it somehow sounds like good, solid, substantial citizens have gotten down and sat down and talked it over. You see, Hitler pointed it out, you know, a long time ago. I must say he did. Hitler said that the way that big people can get by with it is that little people almost always live lives of complete honesty and cannot comprehend people above them being anything other than they are, only in spades. He must be more honest than I am, whereas it's almost invariably quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. And that's how they got there, you see, being a realist. And by the way, realism is not to be confused with cynicism, my dear. So don't fall into that trap. I mean, this is an old canard that is constantly trotted out by these guys who say, oh, those gloom professional gloom dealers. No, it's not the same thing, you know. And so anyway, I'm in this track. I'd like to describe, most of you probably never seen a dog race. Let me tell you how a dog race works. Whippets and greyhounds run. And they have this track, the little itsy-bitsy track, in a way, you see. And there's all those lights and all these sweating people are sitting around. And they bring the dogs out, and they sort of trot them around back and forth on leashes. And these are just plain, ordinary, dumb dogs, and they're very dumb. Oh, yes, the greyhounds and the whippets are the dumbest creatures this side of an amoeba. And they walk back. I know it's terrible to admit that there's such a thing as a dumb dog, my dear, but there are many dumb dogs, just as there are dumb people. It's interesting to note that the porpoise is about 14,000 miles above the dog in the scale of intellectual values, and very well could be several points above man, incidentally. In fact, I was aboard this cruiser, and there was a whole school of porpoises going alongside of us, giving us the old bazoop every 5 minutes. They'd come out of the water and look at this thing and give us the business again. Man was right back after it. This poor old cruiser had been mothballed with the best of intentions to cut out war. And now we've taken off all the shades and we're back at it again. And the porpoises go on. I mean, who is right, you know? Poor clowns. And so I'm sitting at the dog track, sweating away, wearing my full dress uniform, my PFC suit, looking out there, and I have my 75-cent bet on number 7, which was a thin, really ribby-looking creature. Very moth-eaten, and they were walking them back and forth out there. I had never seen a dog race. Let me describe it. And all these dogs were brought together in a little, sort of a little mob, and put into little chutes, and their little tethers were taken off, and there was a ringing of a bell. Boing! No, it's not cruel at all, my dear. No. Wait till I tell you what happens. There's no cruelty involved. I mean, when is there going to be a society called the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Us? I mean, to get us out of this crummy race. I mean, that's what I want. I mean, I'm talking about the great race. You know what the... I know what... You know, have you ever had anybody call you on the phone and say, how is it going, Charlie? How is it going? Well, I'm going to ask you, how is it going? You know what the it is that I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be fantastic if it was taken off of your back? If you could forget all those miserable things, you know, when you're 3 years old, they begin to drum into you that ambition is the soul of honor and goodness. And as a matter of fact, almost invariably, the world has been undone by ambition. All the worst tyrants in history were the most ambitious people in history. Every one of them, every last single one. Do you remember when Castro came in? I don't want political office, he said. I don't want to have anything to do with the art. I'm going to come back and study law again. Yes, sir, that's my baby. Oh, sir, don't mean maybe. And we're, each one of us is just as bad. Give you 30 seconds in the boss's chair and you would become a fiend. Believe me, an absolute, utter, and complete fiend. It's inside within every one of us. Don't think for a minute you're any different. And the reason you're so wonderful is because you've gotten nowhere. Believe me. You have not been given the chance to wield the axe. Given the chance, look out. Nellie, bar the door. And if you couldn't wield the axe, you would never get into that seat. Ever. It's just the rule of thumb of the nature of the jungle. But nevertheless, I'm sitting there, and I'm watching these dogs. And here is the significant point. Suddenly, up pops in front of these dogs a rabbit. A phony rabbit. Let me tell you, it was the phoniest rabbit I've ever seen. And I've seen some phony rabbits in my day. I've worked for some. As a matter of fact, I happen to work now for a genuine rabbit, but a rabbit, you know. And so, nevertheless, I mean, I got nothing against rabbits. But then again, I've got nothing for rabbits either. I can tell you this very definitely. I mean, I can take rabbits or leave them alone, you know? And so this rabbit popped up out of the track and started to run on a track, a little metal mechanical deal. And these dogs took out like idiots after this rabbit, obviously a mechanical rabbit. And they're running like mad. And the rabbit is going, and everything is hot, and all the people jumping up and hollering, and the rabbit is about two jumps ahead of the dogs. And every time the dogs begin to catch up, the guy advances the speed of the rabbit a little bit. He's got a control board, and they run even faster. And then the rabbit goes fast, and they run like mad. They're finally, they all go across the finish line, and the rabbit disappears into the ground. And they lead him off the track sweating, waiting for the next heat. Next time they'll get that rabbit, each one of them says as he's led into his pen. Doesn't that sound familiar? Doesn't that sound familiar, Daddy? Whose life are we describing? Huh? You know what happens when one of the rabbits is caught by a dog? I'll tell you. It happens quite often. Oh, yes. The dog catches up with the rabbit, and he merely gets knocked on his duff. It is an electrical rabbit that has four electrodes sticking out of the back end, and as soon as the dog catches up, pow, on his keister. He gets up and shakes his head and starts to run again, which somehow is precisely what we're all involved in. Yes, sir, that's my baby. Speaking of rabbits, this is WOR AM and FM New York. And we will be here until, well, you know. I mean, you know, you can't... You see, the point being here, there is no point, actually. There's no point. I just told you the story of the dogs. I mean, I could just see this little old lady out in Staten Island. What is this idiot talking about? Would you please change the dial, Elmer, and get me some good music? Get her some good music, please. Good American music. Yes. Ah, yes, madam. Good American music for you. There we are. Isn't that better, madam? This makes sense, doesn't it? Good sound sense. Let me out of you. Let us be out of you. That's much better, Elmer. You finally got rid of that idiot. Heaven's sakes, I don't know how they allow people of that kind to get on the radio. These beatnik types. Always talking about dog races. I can't stand it. I love dogs. Obviously, madam loves people. And Shepherd persists in speaking of them. And the poor senseless rabbits that they pursue endlessly. Endlessly, endlessly through thousands of miles of Walt Disney film. With the same scenery going past them hour after hour. Will you please get that idiot off who keeps interrupting the music? Yes, madam. Pour vous. Just remember... Ladies and gentlemen, in this day, in this moment of our history, 1960, we are playing the Everything is Going to Be All Right polka. By the 10 million sighing somatic strings, lulling you eternally in a bath of amniotic fluid. Of course you've got more automobiles than ever before. And more air conditioners, too. There's no question about that. And you're more, of course, certainly more secure than you ever were. You've made your third payment already on that plot in that friendly eternal resting place out on Long Island, close to the bus station, where your friends can... And it, by the way, it's non-segregated. darling, it's purely Democratic. But you have assured yourself of a preferred position by buying early. Oh, don't stop. Don't stop. Oh, can you imagine the terrible sight of an American who has suddenly been weaned from his mood music? He's out there on that dark, cruel sea. Shall I tell you the awful truth, my dear? That on our warships that are plunging out over that dark Stygian main, there is a loudspeaker in every gun turret that plays mood music? Yes, I'm telling you the truth. And they're also playing The Barbarians Are at the Gates Waltz. For all of you who have gathered to dream for just a moment, for a year, for a decade, maybe for a century. This is such pretty music. There. Don't you feel better now? It's so nice to get out of the rat race. Have you noticed that? I'd like to point out one thing. Have any of you ever seen rats racing? And we eternally call it the rat race. Actually, what you're talking about is the people race. I've never once seen a rat race another rat. As long as I've been around. And I've been around, you know, baby. I've been around. Speaking of being around and getting there, the next time you fly the coop, or at least make the poor, pitiful attempt, you know, you can never do it. Don't think for a moment you can. No matter where you go, you are you. And the saddest sight is the sight of a tourist a million miles away from home trying to find another him. Trying to find another him, you see. He stands and looks at the Fontana di Trevi, and the great waters are rising and falling, and he's wearing his Tom McCann shoes, and he is still literally, thoroughly, and completely him. He will never be anything other than that. He is always an eternal observer, as we all are. And so the poor Italian coming out of the dank little doorway just outside of, let's say, the square of Tritone, he comes out and he has his little postcards and he looks at you and he himself can never escape being himself. We are eternally this way. I would suggest that the next time you make the poor, pitiful attempt, you do it via Lufthansa. At least you will be lulled for a moment. 14,000 miles above the sea. No wonder we love jet flying. It's the most unreal kind of flying there is. I mean, you don't even see the ground in a jet. You are totally and thoroughly in limbo. You know what I'd like to do? I wish some airline, and I'm going to make this suggestion. You know, I sat with a Lufthansa executive, and we talked about this thing. And they have some of these beautiful old DC-6s. I love the DC-6. And these beautiful old Super Connies, which I think is the most graceful of all aircraft. I wish somebody would dig out a biplane. A real biplane with open cockpits. Two open cockpits, you know. A biplane, in case those of you who are completely bred and born in the jets and don't know what a biplane is a thing that has, it's like if you took a piece of the Venetian blind, you know, and you cut it off and it's got two things sticking out from each side and it's got a great big thing sticking up in the back and wheels hanging down. I'd like to ride in an airplane again that has wheels hanging down, you know. And I'd get in the front cockpit and they'd strap me in, you see, thoroughly, complete, just strap me in with my leather jacket and a great big cloud of sheepskin up around my neck. And then I would have my leather helmet pulled down over my eyes, great big goggles, and I would sit there, and there would be a white silk handkerchief that would flow back in the breeze. And I'd sit there, and the pilot would get behind me, and he'd say, "We're taking off." And he'd holler, "Contact!" And the mechanic would grab a hold of the pilot. And by George, we'd be flying. And away we go. Can you imagine what a sensation it would cause if I don't care what airline it would be, just name it, Lufthansa, TWA, KLM, announces that they have a biplane flight now available for the true aficionados who really want to do it. You know, there would be a line of 8 million guys waiting to fly via open biplane. I mean, the dangerous kind of plane that could very well be lost off Greenland forever. I would be the first in line. I don't know why, but I would be there. Wouldn't it be a tremendous thing? And I'm sitting there talking to this guy. I says, you know, why don't they keep a couple of these old, you know, the real airplanes on the routes for people who like to sit for 14 hours? You know, who just like the old steamers. I can't think of anything better than to take a long one-week steamship ride. Really, seriously. Or to fly for 14 hours over this airplane. This airplane that just quietly flies along. But you get into a jet. Now, I've flown into the interior of Europe on a jet. It's a strange sensation. To those of you who have never flown a jet, it is the most unreal sensation that you can imagine. It is really indicative of our time. That flying to Europe has been reduced, I think, to a kind of, you know, like throwing away an old used Kleenex or something. You don't even think twice about it. Let me tell you about the first time I saw Kleenexes. You know, it's funny. I remember some of these things make a vivid impression. I had this teacher named Miss Shields, who was very advanced. Miss Shields had already, in that period, given up Winnie the Pooh and was deep in Little Orphan Annie and Annie Rooney. And she used to read us out by the hours. She used to read us Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy. And I remember one day Miss Shields, who had kind of yellow, you know, the kind of hair that is wiry, that sticks out like a great cloud from the head. She was always wearing a kind of a Brillo pad made out of hair. And Miss Shields is rimless glasses and thin and transparent. And Miss Shields is eternal. She was the only one I ever known, really, who could honestly weep over Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy. Literally weep. And great tears would flow down from behind her rimless glasses when she's reading the story of the balloon fairies. And she's, she was she was really ahead of her time. I mean, she could have been she could have been a woman commentator today. Way ahead of her time. And so Miss Shields is standing up there reading us Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy. And I'm noticing that as she finishes each paragraph that was particularly poignant, she would take something out of her purse, a white handkerchief, and blow her nose. That ladylike nose blow, you know, that little wiping back and forth. And she had one of these razor-like noses that bent from side to side when she would wipe. This is a librarian nose. And she would wipe it back and forth, and then she would tuck it into her purse again. And she would go, and Raggedy Ann said to Raggedy Andy, oh my, the pirates are after us now. Please come away with me, Raggedy Ann. And she would read this, and she would go on, and she would blow her nose again. And then occasionally she would reach into her purse and take out another one and drop the others into the wastebasket. I couldn't imagine what she was doing. I came from a bandana handkerchief, a real bandana family. And big red things and yellow and green. I haven't had a good blue bandana in years. And this is the kind of thing. And she's throwing these things away. Do you know what I did after class? I'll tell you exactly. It's an awful thing. This is a real confession. I looked in the wastebasket to see what they were. And they were paper. I had never seen Kleenex before. And it was kind of a shock. You know, it was the beginning of the plastic world. And I went home and I said, hey, Mom, Miss Shields blows her nose in paper. I had the wrong idea. I thought it was another kind of paper, actually. And she says, well, yeah, she's using Kleenex. I said, Kleenex? What's Kleenex, Ma? She says, she's standing over there by the sink in her rump-sprung bathrobe. And she says, Kleenex is paper handkerchiefs, Ma. I says, but doesn't Miss Shields have real handkerchiefs? She says, Kleenexes are real handkerchiefs. I says, Ma, they're paper. She says, but they're real handkerchiefs. I says, but what about my handkerchief? I take my bandana out of my pocket. She says, that's a bandana. I said, but it's a handkerchief. She says, no, it's a bandana. Miss Shields is using Kleenexes. My mother was going the way of all flesh. And little did I know it. And everywhere. Of course, it was the beginning, you see. It was the beginning of the slow transposition to where today now you can buy a sweater that is called virgin nylon. It's gotten rid of that old crummy wool stuff that we used to have, you know, that old miserable cashmere. And now we have virgin nylon. Can you imagine a guy who can't afford virgin nylon? And so please, please, don't leave me. Hey, Ed. Hey, whoo, don't leave me. Don't leave me. Don't. I need a little shot of dream here. That's better. Give it a little while. That'll make it better. That's what we need. You see, the truth comes out in the most unexpected of all places and tells about our deep-seated fears. As you know, almost all of you are aware that womankind has almost completely abdicated her role in the world of today. Almost completely. But her conscience will not allow her to do so. Man himself, and I'm speaking in the small letter man, he too has abdicated his role. His role of the slayer of saber-toothed tigers, the cracker of clamshells, the ranter and the roarer against the great bolts of lightning that come out of that darkening sky. He no longer rants. He no longer roars. He no longer feels the dark, cutting surge of overwhelming anger. This was man's role. Woman's role has too been abdicated. And so we must somehow gain, if possible, the vicarious substitute. And so man after man buys magazines where women fold out in a three-color spread that remind him of the days when he really chased real women. And he calls it Playboy. Women buy magazines that remind them that there were once days when they were women. And they grated cabbages. And they broke eggs into bowls. And so they, too, remind themselves by hanging bronze-plated cabbage graters on the walls of imitation pine-paneled kitchens. You walk through the kitchen on your way to the Chinese restaurant, night after night, in many East Side apartments. The kitchen has become a repository for a kind of museums of consciences. And hanging on the walls are great bronze-plated pans that once were used for boiling potatoes and are now only used to look at. I even know one chick who has a bronze-plated meat grinder. How basic can you get? The kind that Aunt Min used to stand and shove great chunks of beef into, and sat and grind up the bone and the gristle and all for Uncle Carl's hamburger. She did it just to bug him because she'd thrown his teeth down the air shaft months before, and he just sat there. One time he gummed one of her hamburger balls for over 4 weeks, just gummed it and sucked. But Aunt Min knew what she was doing. It was a war of attrition all the way. And I know this chick on the East Side who has a bronze-plated meat grinder. It's right out of the American home. A handy decorating hint, you see. Oh, yes. I foresee the day when automatic washers will become the antique of our time. The automatic washer. Because there is a man who brings the linens and who leaves. There is a man who brings the dish towel and then leaves. I know apartments where the dish towel hangs only as an old artifact. Just hangs on the wall there. And it's beautifully embroidered. It hasn't seen a dish other than those dishes that are hanging on the wall for years. It's like the appendix. And so womankind has too abdicated her role, just as man no longer finds it possible to be angry, to stalk the wary saber-toothed tiger next to the water cooler. We have both abdicated. And the truth is coming out. Please, give me a little more of that truth music. Truth. American version. Did you read the little news note that came of all places in the Trenton Evening Times? Friday, May 20th, 1960. I have included this in my great catalog of how things really were, so that 10,000 years from now when people dig up our art, they get no idea what the world is like looking at Henry Moore, believe me. They'll get no idea looking at Picasso. But they will get an idea of how we are when they read this. Listen to this. Speaking of womankind abdicating her place and mankind abdicating his, we have to have a symbolic conscience, though, that reminds us of once we were, this we were, A little note from the Trenton Evening Times. I read, I quote, "Have you ever noticed that more and more of the gasoline signs hanging outside service stations are oval in shape? Have you ever noticed that? And many of them are pure white and glow in the dark. Oval shape. What does that remind you of?" Yes, sirree, Bob. It is no accident. An industrial designing firm applied Freudian psychology and concluded that since over 60% of the customers are female, the gasoline signs ought to appeal to them. And what does that ovoid shape remind you of? It's a three-letter word that often pops up in the New York Times crossword puzzle and begins with an O. The second letter is a V. The oval shape was chosen because it is said to quote, and we are quoting the industrial firm, "a symbol of the mother relationship, the egg and the home." As mother whistles down US 1 in her Jag 140D. Would you please fill her up, young man? And mother reaffirms her motherhood once again to the tune of $4.61 worth of 105 proof. Have you noticed gasoline is becoming a Freudian thing? Have you noticed this? Oh, yes, gasoline is no longer sold on its octane or what it does. Oh, indeed. There is a series of TV commercials that scared the wits out of me. It shows this desperate-looking guy sitting there, and he's got a crew cut and a low forehead. Believe me, he's got a low forehead. Have you seen this guy? He's a desperate, and he's got this nervous-looking chick sitting next to him, and he's looking around very, very, very impatiently. He's looking for the guy, obviously. He's looking for the gas station attendant, and he's pulled into a gas station. He's looking around, right? That nervous, irritated, rotten look that you see on the face of everyone running after the mechanical rabbit. And the announcer says, "Men on the go, men of action, choose Watanabe gasoline every time." And he's the guy that I'm always afraid of every time I'm driving. He's that guy that goes, you know, that cuts, that fantastic character that leaps from stop sign to stop sign and from stop street to stop street. He now has a special gasoline made for him. Men on the go. And there will be a gasoline one day, believe me, that will be sold to the contemplative man. Chooses Walden gasoline. And it'll show a guy driving along to the countryside, thinking beautiful thoughts. La, la, la. La, 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 la. And then there will be one sold to the concerned man. And there'll be this guy reading, he's reading the New York Times editorial, and you see him. And coming out of his TV set next to them is the grim, concerned face of Edward R. Murrow. The concerned man uses realist gasoline. So keep your eye out, baby, for the gas station of your choice. Be sure it has that right. Oh, of course, you can't help but, you know, everywhere. Everywhere. A guy said to me the other day, he says, "You know, has it ever occurred to you that we all might be the victims of subliminal propaganda of one kind or other?" And he says, "Wouldn't it be something? Wouldn't it be fantastic if somebody decided to use this?" I said, "But we wouldn't know it if they were. Remember, that's what the whole idea of subliminal is, Jack." He says, "Yeah." He looked at me. "Yeah. And he was wearing his washable, wearable suit. And he was wearing his washable, wearable life. And he was walking, striding into the sunset on Madison Avenue. And you could just see the very edges, the very tips of the great rivers on either side of us. Way down, when you look west and you look east, you can see those eternal waters. And speaking of the eternal waters, do you remember the story of that ship? That ship that sank out here in the East River just a few weeks ago? This ship was coming along, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning. Get this now. This is right here in the heart of good old friendly Manhattan. And you, of course, are aware that the street department... Now, get this, Jack. The street department is still maintaining hunting teams who spend their nights hunting throughout the water supply system of New York, dark, deep under the subways, way down under your feet, hunting alligators. Do you know that there are alligators living right under the surface of Manhattan? And everyone says, oh, no, it can't be. Oh, yes, it is. And you know where they came from? There was a tremendous fad, if you remember, a few years ago, people buying alligators and sending them back from Florida. You remember those? For a dollar and sending them back to Cousin Min in the Bronx? Yes. Well, what happened after you have an alligator around the house for a while, you get kind of tired of the look on its face. And what do you do with an alligator? You don't throw them out, you know, you just toss them out in the garbage. Well, what happened with most people is it's a funny little thing. Yes, they wound up in the water supply. Guess how? But the thing about an alligator, baby, is that he's amphibious. And more than that, he's highly adaptable. And that water supply system down under the streets of New York is kept at a constant temperature, you know. It does not freeze down there. And so they grew to great size until this very day, right under your feet, 14-foot alligators are stalking. And little men with little lights on their helmets are looking for them. Just thought you ought to know. And so that ship is going along the East River at 3 o'clock in the morning, right by the UN building, the central heart of the nerve system of all assembled humanity, when suddenly something on the bottom of the river, something on the bottom of the East River, that friendly old river out there, ripped the bottom of this boat right out. Do you know how much of a rip it made in it? There were 20 compartments in this ship, which was almost 800 feet long. It ripped a line right down the middle of the ship through 16 of the compartments, like a gigantic can opener. And at last reports, they still hadn't found what it was. Under the East River. All the guy could say, we're sinking, Charlie! And they drove it up on the beach right next to symbolically enough, right next to the UN building. Where better for a sinking ship to be pulled up to remind the natives, to remind the denizens of what it's like. And the water is pouring in. Speaking of the water, we have with us tonight the paper book gallery. Deep down dark in the heart of seething Greenwich Village. And it does seethe. And I would like to recommend that if you're taking the village thing tonight, if you got nothing to do, I can think of no better place to go to spend your... You know, interestingly enough, the paper book gallery is becoming recognized more as a place to go than as a place to buy books. Isn't that sad? I said, oh, yeah, I went to all the paper book. I says, what did you get? He said, oh, I don't buy no books. He just goes and stands around with Schopenhauer glaring at him and Kant and Kierkegaard. And incidentally, the one who would understand that most of all is Kafka, looking down at this poor clown bathing himself in the aura of books. Well, if you'd like to do it, it's the Paper Book Gallery down on Sheridan Square. And remember, it's the Paper Book Gallery. They have deliberately placed four steps in which you go down to get into this place. It reminds you of the mortality of which you are part of. You can't escape it. And you will find that this is undoubtedly one of the most intriguing shops of any kind you've ever been in New York City. There are two of them. There's one on 3rd Street. And incidentally, the one on 3rd Street, by the way, the gallery will be open till 2 o'clock this morning. The greatest collection of paper books probably in America. But two doors down from the one on 3rd Street, at 82 West 3rd Street, is Ying and Yang, which unquestionably, to me at least, is one of the finest Oriental restaurants in New York. And according to Gourmet Magazine, is one of the finest five Oriental restaurants in the United States, which I will not go so far as saying. You know, I'm beginning to have a great unfaith in reviewers. Reviewers obviously are emotional people. I wonder what Walter Kerr thinks every time he walks past that sign that says, a best blah, 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 musical I've seen in years. You know, the one with a four-letter word in it. And it's literally one of the worst. So, what happened that night anyway? Too many olives. But nevertheless, Ying and Yang at 82 West 3rd Street is truly one of the finest Oriental restaurants in America. And they are open on Sunday. You'll find, and it's very difficult to find a restaurant, a good restaurant, open in New York on Sunday. And if you're going out for dinner, you'll find them open tonight till 10. You'll find them open, 10, 11, they're open till 1. And you'll find them open till 2 o'clock in the morning, most weeknights. And they open at noon tomorrow, and they will be open until midnight. And this is 82 West 3rd Street, Ying and Yang, and they have a bar. They have a bar. Now, don't... You see, he jumped over his air conditioner. It was only a drop of 35 feet. That's the point, you see. Over the air conditioner.
Over WOR Radio, your station for news.
A man with drive.
A man with drive. Yes.
Well, this is WBAI New York, and you've been listening for the last 90 or so minutes to Gene Shepherd from his Saturday afternoon broadcast. On July 30th, 1960. Fascinating stuff. And let me remind you again that ordinarily, here on WBAI in New York, you'd be listening to Dave Kenny's Everything Old is New Again. Dave took the night off. He'll be back next week, I believe, at the new time of 11 p.m. Golden Age of Radio will be going from 9 to 11 from now on. On the 16th of this month, on Father's Day, we'll be bringing you Bloomsday live from, 6:30, Simon Locley, our own Joycean scholar, will be setting up the live broadcast that will go from 7 o'clock until about 1 a.m. So all programming will be preempted on that evening for Bloomsday. Something to look forward to. And, by the way, you can regularly hear Gene Shepherd at the end of my other program called Mass Backwards, which is heard Monday night into Tuesday morning from 4 to 6 a.m. And actually tomorrow, I put the show on tape because I'm going off to some sort of a family reunion. See my sainted old mother and my sainted old sisters and all the rest of the clan. So I'm not going to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday. I put a tape in, which will feature a 90-minute Limelight broadcast from May of 1966 and Gene Shepherd's, an early version of his story of the prom. So if you need more Shepherd, go right there. Or go on the World Wide Web and hear the other programs that have been broadcast, about 6 or 8 of them available for download and listening at a website called flicklives.com, www.flicklives, FLICKLIVES.com. And that's where you'll find portions of the Mass Backward Show and more Gene Shepherd. Pardon me. Now, to round out the time, 11 o'clock, Bill Farrar and Jazz Sampler will be here, but we're going to bring you a portion of a record of Gene Shepherd, 1964 release, Gene Shepherd Live at the Limelight, and listen to a story of the Triangular Donut. So, stand by, and we'll be back with Gene Shepherd a couple of years after the broadcast we just heard in a live setting. And do stay tuned. This is WBAI New York.
When I was a kid, this was during the Depression. And during the Depression, there used to be magazines called stuff like Popular Mechanics. Do you know any Popular Mechanics? You know, it suddenly occurred to me, it's a great name, Popular Mechanics, you know. Popular Plumbing. They had all these great articles even more than the National Geographic and Photoplay, Popular Mechanics is a pure magazine of fantasy. It's a magazine of dreams. And I remember pictures of guys, you know, those smeary little pictures that shows a guy standing like this. It says, Ezra J. Seastrump of Clearwater, Iowa, shown beside his model of the George Washington Bridge, which he built over a 17-year period using used toothpicks. And it shows him standing, and there's the George Washington Bridge. Nobody's working. It didn't tell him how to do things like we would learn today, like paint your car, how to build a breezeway. Nobody had anything. So everything was totally impractical. How to build a color organ. How to build a harp out of cigar boxes. Yeah, and piano wire. They really did have articles like that. It would show this guy playing a harp, you know. Yes, sir, that's my baby. And the building of it was more important than even the concern for what it did. And more important than that, nobody built any of it. They just read about it. And they would think, gee, wouldn't it be great if I had a color organ? In the afternoon, Bing Crosby Records would come on and it would light up blue and red. And I could sit there and watch all the colors. And in the back, now this is where it really got serious. In the back pages of Popular Mechanics was where the dreams really grew. There would be an ad saying, earn big money in the private crime detection industry. They would show this guy wearing a cloak with a high silk hat, with a cane, with an ivory head. It says, there is Agent X-10 trailing a dangerous operative. The Kansas City School of Applied Police Techniques will send you a free lesson. Send your name and address to Big Doe, Kansas City. You know, and guys could imagine themselves with capes, you know, and ivory-headed canes, trailing guys who had stole tires off the Model A's. Somehow it was a dream world. And one of the greatest of all the ads that appeared in the back pages of this particular publication, I once saw actually work. One time, I'm this kid, and living next door to us was a guy named Bruner. Let me tell you about Bruner. He played a great part in my life because Bruner represents Beowulf, you know? Bruner was drunk through the entire Depression. He was bombed, you know? He was always... Bruner would come home, and Bruner could do things with apricots. He had all kinds... Listen, he invented jungle juice before there were jungles. And Bruner worked at the railroad one day a year. He was on the extra board. The extra board at the railroad means when everybody else is off, when all the trains have sunken into the bay, they call old Bruner. And Bruner would arrive down at the roundhouse and do whatever he did at the roundhouse and then wouldn't come home for 3 days. He was celebrating his day of work. He would come home then 3 days later and you could hear him crawling up the driveway. And you could see Mrs. Bruner there framed in that screen door window standing there, you know, sort of fat with her flowered house coat. With her copy of True Story in her hand. And she'd say, easy, Ralph, the second step now. You're on the second one. And Ralph would come staggering up. He would reel in, and you'd hear the door slam, and then you'd start to hear the yelling. And then it would slowly, quietly die down, and Bruner would be hibernating again till the next day that he was called. Well, one time, in the back pages of Popular Mechanics, there was a full-page ad that ran for about a year. And it said, earn big money at home in the triangular donut business. It said that there is a tremendous, untapped demand for triangular donuts. And the ad was in big, bold type. It says, men, don't wait for opportunity. Go after it. And it shows this guy with a great big coat on, with a fur collar, with a Homburg hat. And you see trucks behind him. It's a triangular Acme Donut Company. It shows this guy has started in his basement with the triangular donut machine that cooked them while you watched. And there was a picture of the machine. It looked like some kind of a little chromium cage with glass windows on it. And it was a coupon. It says, don't wait now. Virgin territories are still open for the right men. You may be the right man. It says, send their name and address, and you would receive the machine, and you would pay for it out of your earnings. Only accepting a $200 down payment. Well, let me tell you what happened. One afternoon, a truck arrived, a railway express truck in front of the Bruner's house. Bruner's house was one of those houses, you know, with the weeds growing up out in front. Yeah, and the screen doors hung crooked, and they had a front porch swing. Well, Mrs. Bruner would sit there and rock, and one day out in front of their house arrived this big truck. And, of course, everybody's, you know, they all the kids are playing ball and all that, and it's summertime, and they're unloading this truck, and old man Bruner came out, and he was all excited. You rarely saw him excited. He was all excited. He's out there talking to the guys, you know, and they got papers, and they're bringing this thing in. And they're loading it up on the porch. It's a gigantic crate. The thing stood about 8 feet high. And of course, everybody's looking out of the window. What do they got, a refrigerator or what, you know? Look at that bum. He hasn't worked in 7 months. They bought a refrigerator. What is this? And then you could hear Bruner ripping the nails down in the basement. It's all coming apart. And 20 minutes later, there is a knock at the door, and there is Bruner. It's the first time I ever saw Bruner dressed in a suit. He was a mechanic, you know. He always dressed as a mechanic. And here he is in a gray, one of those knobbly gray suits with a little slight bulge at the knee, little tacky, but he's all dressed up. He's got a white shirt on. And he knocks on the door, and my mother answers. What do you say? You know, there's this man. And she says, oh, Mr. Bruner, hi, Ralph. And he's very formal. He says, I'm here to take your orders for triangular donuts. He says, I have opened a triangular donut route, and I'm here to take your order. Well, my mother sort of goes back, you know, we're all standing here, and everybody, he's, you know, this is a real thing. And my mother says, oh, yes, triangular donuts. Yes, very, well, how much are they? 26 cents a dozen plain, 31 cents a dozen with powdered sugar. My mother said, well, I'll have a half dozen plain and one dozen powdered sugar. Thank you very much, Mrs. Shepherd. Thank you. Mr. Bruner goes down the steps. He goes to the next house where the Bryces live. And we're looking out of the window. You know, it's a wild scene. He's going, and he's got a little case, and he writes it down. You know, he's got a little book. They sent order books with it, you know, and the whole thing, he's writing it down. Next door, you see Mrs. Bryce talking to him. And then he walks on to the next house. And the neighborhood just hung there. Nobody knew whether to applaud or whether to get mad. Here's a guy really doing something. About 2 days later, right early in the morning, you could smell stuff in the neighborhood, you know. You could smell all kinds of burning stuff, and smoke is swirling, and you could smell it, you know, the greasy thing in the air. And suddenly, Bruner, at 7 o'clock in the morning, before breakfast, is knocking on the door. And my mother opens the door, and there he is. He's got a white coat on. He says, your triangular donut man is here. And he's got these things in a white cardboard box, and he hands them to my mother. And she says, oh, thank you very much. How much is that? He says, well, a half dozen of the plain and a dozen of the powdered. Let's see, that's 47 cents, please. Although I can put it on the book if you want. I can extend credit. And she says, no, I'll pay. And she goes up to the icebox, you know, and gets the thing out and brings it out. She says, oh, thank you very much, Mr. Bruner. He says, when shall I call again? Shall I deliver again before breakfast next Wednesday? She says, yes, yes, yes. And Bruner goes down with his white coat. And we look at him. We're watching out of the window. He's got a little cart. One of the saddest things I ever saw. He's got a wagon. He's got Junior Bruner's wagon. He has painted it green. And on the side of it, it says Triangular Donut Inc. And he is now next door. And my mother brings these donuts, and she opens them up, and she says, here, here, come on, here, have some coffee. Let's have donuts. And they really were triangular. Little triangular pieces of mud. And she passes them around. We take them, you know. They were just fantastically bad. Oh, they were terrible, just terrible. And, you know, the kids don't even like them, and that's really bad. And we chew them at my kid brother right away. There's always a real outspoken kid. Oh, Ma, these are rotten. I don't want any. And my mother's got a dozen and a half of Mr. Bruner's dreams right in her hand. And my father, you know, says, you know, these aren't bad, especially the ones that have got the sugar on them. Not bad. He's dipping them in, you know, so they melt and all that. Well, about 10 o'clock that morning, there is another knock at the door. It is Mr. Bruner. He's got his white coat, and he says, I want to ask you how you like the donuts. I am putting in a line of black walnut donuts. Would you like some black walnuts? My mother says, they're very good. They were very good, Mr. Bruner. They're very good donuts. I'm surprised. Where did you learn to make donuts? He said, oh, it's nothing. So I've been in business for years, you know. I used to be in the donut business before I got into the roundhouse business on the extra board. Nothing to it at all. He was really playing it big. Well, nobody in the neighborhood knew what to do. My mother is talking to Mrs. Bryce, and Mrs. Bryce says, did you get those terrible donuts? And Mrs. Parker down the street comes down, you know, they're all having the coffee clutch, and they're all saying, oh, what terrible donuts, what are we going to say? And sure enough, like death and taxes, Wednesday arrives. There's Bruner. Your donuts are here, I'm in a hurry. Donuts, donuts. He shoves the donuts, you know, now he's very brisk, it's his second run. And my mother gives him the 42 cents and brings him in, and we're hoping, everybody's hoping they're better. You know, he's learned in the week how to make them. They're even worse. He figures he's got a big business now, cut down on the shortening. You know? Which at that point was axle grease anyway. Well, Bruner brings these things in, and they're just awful. They're just terrible. And Bruner then says, what shall I do? Shall I bring any more donuts? When do you want? Would you like to try the black walnut? My mother says, well, Mr. Bruner, my husband's got diabetes. My father was as healthy as a fire plug. And he says, really? And I don't think the kids should eat donuts so much. I'm trying to get the kids to lay off the sweet stuff. And I think, let's skip a week. And Bruner goes next door. And you could see the same thing happening next door. 1 week later, he arrives and says, any donuts? My mother says, yeah, bring me a half dozen. He says, oh, thank you. And gradually, he stopped coming around. And then finally, it was all over. And Saturday nights would arrive. And you'd hear Bruner crawling up the steps. He'd crawl up. You'd hear Mrs. Bruner saying, Ralph, the second step is loose. Watch it. You'd hear Bruner going down. You know, it was like Sisyphus. And you'd hear him going down the basement step. Then he'd boom, boom. And then it would go quiet again. Well, about a month later, I am down in the basement. You know how kids play in the basement? And they're back by the coal bin. with a bunch of old tires and old barrels is this donut machine. It's covered with dust, and oil, and crud. And on the side, it said Triangular Donut Company. And I'm playing back there, and you know how kids are. They're very, I don't know what's with them. I knew what it was, and I'm playing with Bruno, and I says, hey, what's the machine? Bruno, what is that thing? He said, I don't know. It's something my dad's got. I said, what is it? What is it? What is it? You know, all excited. What is it? And he opens the thing up, and we're playing in it, and we're banging around, and Mr. Bruner comes down the steps. Junior! And Junior says, what is it, Dad? Stop playing in my donut machine! Okay, Dad. And we crawl out. 4 months go by, and I see this junk truck out in back. They are giving him $20 for the donut machine. They're carrying it out. And Bruner's helping them load it on. Like this. Don't give up hope. The following spring, what do you think arrives in front of the Bruner's house? A gigantic machine to retread old tires.
Gene Shepherd, Live at the Limelight, 1964 album. Thanks to Jim Clavin for the loan and for the flicklives.com website. Thanks to Bill Farrar, sitting here patiently for a live broadcast for the loan of the last 2 minutes. It's 11:02. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York.